Right, let's get started with our next session and moving a bit more onto a question that's already been touched on but is clearly very important, which is that of remedies. And so first to discuss that topic, we have Trevor Cook from Bird & Bird.
Thank you, Sir Richard, and thank you, Lionel, for the invitation to speak. Yes, as Richard said, I'm going to be talking about we've heard already about abuses in relation to securing rights, and I'm now going to be talking about abuses in relation to how those rights are asserted. But I shall mainly be focusing on abuses in relation to how those rights are not asserted, because I shall be talking about unjustified threats of actions for infringement of intellectual property rights. We'll be going a little into the issue of abusive litigation, but I think we'll hear much more of that later. So the focus of this is very much on unjustified threats, and as characterized, I think, in one case, those people who are willing to wound yet afraid to strike. And this is those people who go around saying that you infringe an intellectual property right, but not doing anything about it. And the particular evil of people who go around saying that one infringes an intellectual property right and go and tell your customers that the product they're buying from you infringes an intellectual property right. So we have UK legislation as to this. It's very long and complicated, so I shall not be going into it in enormous detail. I think, in a sense, the more interesting aspect is how we got to where we are now. And also, another interesting aspect is what has happened in those other countries that, like the UK, lack a generalized unfair competition regime, which you would have thought is the natural way of being able to deal with these things. And they've adopted a number of different approaches, and we learn from each other, and we sometimes fail to learn from each other, and things get done for no apparent reason. But before moving on to that, let me just talk about other mechanisms which exist apart from this statutory regime against unjustified threats. And this is a sort of typology which I've taken from the Law Commission report of 2013, of other English common law remedies. I think the main one that identifies malicious falsehood or trade libel or injurious falsehood. If you go around saying that somebody infringes your rights, if you say it maliciously and no real belief in it, then yes, that could well be malicious falsehood. If you say you have rights which don't exist, that also could be. But as discussed in the Law Commission report, it's certainly not enough to go to provide any meaningful remedy. Certainly the requirement to demonstrate malice can be highly problematic. They also discuss defamation, contempt of court, inducing breach of contract, intentionally causing loss by unlawful means. One can also, of course, secure declaratory relief at vast expense if people are bad-mouthing you, suggesting that you are infringing a valid right. But one other possible approach, which was discussed in the Law Commission report, and I think it's fair to say that all of these other possible common law remedies not much has changed in terms of the law since the Law Commission report, but of these other common law remedies, abuse of process has in fact, the law relating to abuse of process has in fact changed. Supreme Court case decision in 2016, Willis and Joyce. The Gregory and Portsmouth City Council case, which it held was no longer good law, was the basis for the Law Commission saying that there wasn't really any meaningful way in which abuse of process could be asserted in relation to actions for unjustified threats, because the Gregory case essentially said that abuse of process only related to criminal proceedings and not civil ones. Willis and Joyce has chipped away at that. It's one of those rare examples of a 9-judge panel in the UK Supreme Court. Normally they have only 5 judges, but when they've got something very difficult and they've got differing Court of Appeal cases to resolve, they can go to 9. Consequence of having 9 judges is that whilst you have, this is a majority opinion, 5-4, with possibly some of the more effective and better reasoned judgments in the minority. But even the majority would say that those occasions when you can actually use malicious prosecution against abuses of civil proceedings will be limited. But we'll see. There is a chink in the wall anyway in relation to that. So that is all I was going to say about the English common law generally. So you see, it doesn't really provide much of a mechanism against groundless threats of infringement. In terms of actual abuses in litigation itself, you know, there are all of the cost regimes and the cost remedies which can be applied. If you're dragged into English litigation, that is problematic enough in itself. So let's go on to look more at the statutory regime. So in the UK, we have this all set out in the... the slides are stuck, huh? No? Okay. Thanks so much, Ralph. Okay, sorry about that. And so those were the various, that was the typology which I was talking about just now, of those various other potential causes of action which might be available in relation to abuses. Some of those, of course, like abuse of process, malicious prosecution, which I was going into a bit more detail about, very much relate to the litigation itself, rather than to just threatening customers with an intellectual property right. Actions for breach of an intellectual property right. So the UK legislation itself is now effectively set out in the 2017 Act, which covers all those various rights, patents, trademarks, various types of design, and it amends all those various pieces of legislation which cover those various intellectual property rights. I think, as Sir Richard mentioned earlier, copyright is omitted from the list. You could argue for, if you're trying to have a coherent approach to this, you could say, well, patents, trademarks, registered designs, they are all registered rights, they're monopoly rights. But that argument falls over when you come to unregistered designs. They're not, by definition, registered rights. So there is already a sort of lack of coherence in our approach, but the reason we have unregistered rights in there, and I think this was actually a point which was made by the IP judges when they were responding to the consultation by the Law Commission, which led to the 2017 Act. You know, why isn't copyright there? Or if you're not going to have copyright, why have unregistered designs? It's something of an accident of history. These provisions were addressed, or an amendment was incorporated in the same act, the 1988 Act, Copyright Designs and Patents Act, which introduced the unregistered design right because of the previous excesses in relation to using copyright to protect functional designs. And we'll see, certainly when we come to look at some of the other legislation in other countries, that a lot of this is an accident of history. You can see certain generations of threats provisions emerging over time. So I've tried to summarize some of the main aspects of the current UK legislation as to unjustified threats. I have not set it out in the main body of this presentation in full, because even as to just the provisions for one intellectual property right, they take up about seven of these slides. So I've left them at the end in an appendix. So we start with threats of infringement proceedings in respect of specified intellectual property rights, patents, designs, whatever, made by any person or actionable by a person aggrieved by the threat. And that will generally be the person who is actually, whose product or whose service is in issue. And it is a defense to show that the threat was actually justified because the right in issue was valid and infringed. But what we have in the UK legislation, and what I don't think has got into legislation in most other countries in the world, is a distinction made between threats to a primary infringer, namely someone who's carried out or intends to carry out the primary acts of infringement, such as manufacture, importation, and so on, and secondary infringers who we can effectively equate to the customers of the primary infringer. UK legislation also has specific provisions that in certain restricted circumstances, such as seeking to discover the identity of the primary infringer, one can communicate with somebody who is a secondary infringer without falling foul of the threats provisions, as long as it's essentially the only way you could actually find out information about the primary infringer. There's also a provision which is retained from the very earliest days of the UK legislation, which is that giving notice that the right in question exists does not found liability for the threats action. And that was very much about the only let out, apart from having to have an action to demonstrate the threat was justified, which existed when I started practicing best part of 50 years ago, I suppose. Yes. But in those days, one would, as a patentee, acting for a patentee, all one could really do was either sue somebody without any notice or just send them a copy of the patent. And just sending somebody a copy of the patent, you know, letter on solicitor's notepaper, although the fancier solicitors didn't even say they were solicitors on their notepaper. Sending somebody a letter, we said, "Dear sirs, here is UK patent 1 million, whatever it was. Yours faithfully." If you said anything more, it was a threat. This resulted in somewhat surreal conversations, such as people phoning you up and saying, "Why have you sent me a copy of that patent?" And what can you say in response, which would not itself constitute a threat? So that was all rather difficult. So it's much easier just to sue people. And because the writs were cheap, the CPR did not mandate people getting on with litigation in those days, in the same way they do now. Very little or no case management. There wasn't really much downside to that. So that was the way to really deal with that from the patentee's point of view. So that's not really an ideal way of proceeding. So we have these various let outs this way. And there's this last provision. A professional advisor acting in their professional capacity and on instructions from their client does not face personal liability for making threats. And that's a feat, that's a provision which you find in many of the much of Commonwealth legislation. But it addresses a real problem. Because of certain ways in which the legislation used to be drafted, because it spoke about primary acts and infringement and secondary acts and infringement. If, for example, you made an allegation to a primary infringer that they were also undertaking secondary acts of infringement, you found that you were liable for threats. And so many professional advisors, pretty innocently, did not draft their letters with sufficient care to only threaten primary infringers in relation to primary for acts of infringement. And thus, some professional advisors found themselves sued for threats. And that's problematic in two ways. Their client, well, the first way, sort of formalistic legal problem, that they and their client have been both being sued for threats. They had different interests, and there is potential conflict. The more practical problem, in a sense, is you look really silly in front of your client if you've been sued for the very act of seeking to enforce their rights and writing a letter before action with insufficient care, so that you found yourself being sued for it. This provision means that that is no longer a problem. And there were real cases in which that happened. So let's have a short history of UK unjustified threats law. And it's a very short, and this is too short actually, because it misses out the Patents Act 2004, which was quite a significant feature. But what I've set out at the start there is the very first piece of UK threats legislation back in 1883. And that was a result of an 1880 case, Halsey and Brotherhood. Like all the best cases of the Victorian times about steam engines, where a particular manufacturer of steam engines went around threatening the customers of a competing manufacturer of steam engines. He never sued, but he threatened with his patents, and the competing manufacturer was unable to secure any relief in relation to these threats. And so we have this provision, which was the origin of all of these, of all of this threats legislation. 1907 was extended to registered designs. 1932, the last sentence of Section 32 was omitted. something which said mere notification, the mere notification of which I spoke was not a threat. Banks Committee report, which led to the Patents Act 1977, that introduced the concept of primary versus secondary infringers, and we then had the provisions in relation to designs in the 1988 Act, introduced into the Trademarks Act 1994. Then in 2004, you had the Patents Act, which was primarily directed to implementing EPC 2000 in UK law, but also had some tweaks to the threats provisions, such as one that you would not fall foul of the threats provisions if the only reason that you failed in an infringement action against somebody was that the patent was invalid and you had no reasonable grounds for thinking it was invalid. And we then had a lot of satellite litigation about threats, and eventually the Law Commission was asked to take a grip of this, and that produced the current situation of 2017, the 2017 Act. Now let's just look at some unjustified threats legislation elsewhere. This is by no means a complete list. There is more work to be done putting this together, and there is also an interesting exercise to be done in looking at the various generations of these provisions. But I wanted to pick out some in particular. Australia has threats in provisions in relation to copyright. Indeed, Section 202A has threats provisions in relation to infringement of technical protection measures. Also, an interesting feature of the Patents Act in Australia, which I'll come back to when we come back to the question of remedies for unjustified threats, is a provision for flagrant damages or additional damages, as we must now call them in UK parlance. India, I think its threats provisions are only limited to patents. Ireland is interesting. It has followed the UK in many respects, but it also has a provision in relation to copyright. Now, this is not, is it a threats provision? Section 141, a person who for financial gain makes a claim to enjoy a right under this part, which he or she knows or has reason to believe is false, shall be guilty of a criminal offence. So it's a bit like saying that your product is patented, which is a criminal offence under, well, it's not, which is a criminal offence under UK law. But actually, the way it's framed, it could be asserted more broadly. My Irish colleagues tell me this, it's never been asserted. Nobody really knows what it means. But it's not, what I haven't worked out is why it's actually there in the first place. Malaysia, I have specifically checked the Malaysian provisions for registered designs and for patents, but they only have threats provisions in relation to trademarks. And given the, one of the points I could have made is when you look at the various dates of these acts, and these are all the more recent ones, you can see how people have taken some threats provisions from other countries. I mean, they all started off with something which looked rather like the UK threats provisions of 1883, and they gradually modified over time. New Zealand is an interesting case because of what I think one New Zealand commentator has talked about, the incoherence of its threats regime. It has no threats provision now in relation to patents. It used to have one in relation to patents under the 1953 Act, corresponding to that in the 1953 Designs Act. But the Copyright Act and the Trademarks Act are interesting because they do not relate to threats. What instead they relate to is in unjustified proceedings. So they are really very much a sort of abuse of proceedings provisions. And it's clear the Trademarks Act one was just pulled out of the copied from the Copyright Act one, but and also in the appendix to this, there's a reference to a very good article about the development of New Zealand threats law and its incoherence, and how that has arisen. Now, to start wrapping up, what would I say are the current controversies in UK threats law? I mean, what you can say is that I think it's fair to say the 2017 Act addressed, you know, despite its extraordinary length, which I think Robin Jacob was highly critical of in his comments of it, but despite that, it has been generally successful in addressing all the various problems which had arisen before in relation to threats in the UK courts and the satellite litigation you had in relation to it. Perhaps it's over-engineered, but it's done the job. Now, David mentioned earlier the question of online platform dispute resolution mechanisms. And there have been a couple of cases of which the latest one is the NoCo Company one. It does appear to me that whilst I'm not suggesting that the existing cases in relation to these are wrong in any way, but it does suggest to me that if threats provisions can be used in this way against people who use the dispute resolution mechanisms of online platforms against bad actors, they can also be used in that way against good actors. And it seems to me that the threats provisions risk undermining the online platform dispute resolution mechanisms. And I don't think that's a discussion which has been properly had. There's an open question at the moment, which we're going to appeal fairly shortly, I understand, and that is whether the freedom of speech provisions of the European Convention of Human Rights have been adequately reflected or adequately taken account of in the threats provisions. But I think the first instance decision certainly did address that. So we wait to see what happens on appeal. And then there's a wider question of relief. Lux World case earlier this year, I don't know whether that's going to appeal or not, but I mean, what the threats provisions speak of is, in terms of relief, is injunction and damages. They do not provide for an account of profits. And it's the same problem as one has in relation to seeking to claim under a cross-undertaking damages. You can get damages, but not an account of the wrongdoer's profits. And in many of these cases, you can envisage that the account of profits would be more substantial than the damages. And indeed, there is another case, which I think is now dead given that Court of Appeal decision, the Cabo Concepts for MGA Entertainment one. Now that is a combined case of threats and abuse of a dominant position under Article 102, or whatever the Chapter 2 prohibition is under the Competition Act, under the UK Competition Act, which corresponds to Article 102. And in that, you had a toy manufacturer who had all his distributors, and he's and a startup competitor was trying to get their product into these distributors. The toy manufacturer said, well, infringes our patents on this similar thing. And the also, if you, our distributors, stop this product, then we'll stop supplying to you. And so liability was established. But there was no relief whatsoever, because the counterfactual was that even had the threats not been made, even had the abuse not occurred, the business of the wronged party would have failed anyway. So the wrongdoer had only to pay the not insubstantial, I imagine, given it was fought like as a competition law case and not an intellectual property case, costs of the litigation. So to reflect on that and to wrap up, I don't necessarily hold as an English lawyer that the threats, having a statutory threats regime, is the way to go. When you see how many changes there have been made over time, when you see the variations between different countries which have such a statutory regime, it's very hard to see. It's difficult to justify it from that point of view. But if we don't have an unfair competition approach, then there is value in such a regime. There are questions about what rights should such regimes cover. And one of the problems of statutory regimes we see, if you start tinkering with them piecemeal, right by right, different stages, then there's inconsistency between them. But I hope I've also identified some new issues which are starting to emerge with our statutory regime. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Trevor. So the reason why Willis and Joyce was 9 judges in the Supreme Court was to address the status of Privy Council authority. Otherwise, it would have been 7 judges. The reason why the 2017 Act only covered copyright and was because the Law Commission was not asked to look at copyright. And to explain to those of you who don't know, the Law Commission depends on its work being paid for by a sponsoring department. The sponsoring department was the DTI. Copyright was regarded as trespassing into DCMS. DCMS didn't want anything to do with it, so hence copyright was out of scope for the project. This is how policy gets made. Right, next up we have Katarina Foss-Selbrecht from the University of Copenhagen talking about interim injunctions.